Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments, hanging gardens, and superstructures were lauded, listed, and visited as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. Later, Magnificent Sevens have included spectacular constructions such as Machu Picchu and the Taj Mahal, or awesome natural phenomena such as the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guest in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is the comedian Jeff Norcott. At the turn of the millennium, Jeff was an English teacher in London, trying his hand at stand-up comedy in the time he had left over from preparing lesson plans and marking homework. Since which time, he has developed into a fully-fledged, full-time performer and writer, with several Edinburgh shows and nationwide tours under his belt, as well as countless appearances on TV and radio programmes. He's written for newspapers and magazines, and even the odd book. He may or may not miss the joys of morning assembly or listening to Class 4B reciting scenes from Shakespeare, but he now talks to late-night audiences who are more or less grown up. Now, Jeff, as many people will know, you've come to prominence despite, or even because, you occupy an almost unique position in the modern world of stand-up comedy, as you identify as being on the right rather than the left side of politics, support of the Conservative Party, Brexit and so on. I think it was your wife, Emma, who suggested you make that a feature of your stand-up act.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible, this comedy game whereby being slightly right of centre and voting in line with 52% of the country is this radical proposition that sort of you become like a diversity booking. But I mean, it's not being mealy-mouthed, but I suppose I'd always say that I'm a voter rather than a sort of ideologue. So a lot of the political decisions I've made are like most normal people, on balance, I leaned a certain way. But it was, you're right, my wife, you said it, because I'd been a club comedian for a while, but I didn't feel like I was sort of tested. I was quite safe as a club comic. Yeah. And I thought, well, is there anything I could do that would be dangerous and have a bit more jeopardy? And my wife said, well, you know, you vote Conservative. That's a bit weird for you a lot, isn't it? And I was like, it is weird. As you all know, Clive, it's very weird. Well, it's weird to admit it.
Yeah, well, yes, it's weird, I suppose, especially given, well, I've mentioned you're a teacher before you're a comedian. You make a thing about coming from a working class background. You went to Goldsmiths College. You're a stand-up comedian. All these point in direction of saying you should either be supporting the leader of the Labour Party or attacking him for not being radical enough. That's the standard position for all those groups, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when it comes to class, I mean, one of the things in writing the book that I kind of realised was that my family, I think, was meant to be middle class. If you look at the trajectory going back, we hadn't quite arrived there, but we were on an upwardly mobile curve. And then it was my parents getting divorced in the 80s that actually was the kind of, you know what comedy is like a misdirection. That was like a misdirection for our family. And my mum elected to leave my dad with the house, which is quite a novel approach for a woman divorcing her husband. Yes, you know what? Yeah. I'll leave you with the house and we'll go and live in a council estate in Wimbledon, which first up sounds like a paradox anyway. No one believes that there's anything other than strawberries and Pimm's in Wimbledon and you know, really good equity in your house. But that period had just happened to be the formative period of my life. You know, socially and politically, it was between the ages of, you know, kind of 9 to kind of 16, 17. So I grew up not poor, but we flirted with poverty from time to time, you know. Yeah. So that has been, that formed me. But now, you know, I live in Cambridgeshire now. I've known the taste of brioche. I can't, you know, I always try and be honest about exactly where I'm at. So a lot of the trappings of my life now would be seen as middle class. But I feel like that boy who's still trying to run from that poverty that he felt on that council estate.
Well, that doesn't make you as unique, because an awful lot of comedians come from relatively poor backgrounds. And then when they're making a bit of money, they are embarrassed about the fact that they now taste the wine before they have a meal in a restaurant, which wasn't what they did when they got that, you know, that sort of thing. That's fairly sad. So, but it's the I suppose before we can get on to why, you know, why you might be right of centre or left of centre, you know, comedians don't always have to have a political position at all. I mean, Morecambe and Wise, were they left or right? Were Frankie Howard, you know, what did they even have a political position that you could discern? But it is a part of a lot of people's comedy these days that you want to tell your audience where you are or where you stand on the big issues.
I think that comedy in a way just reflects society. If you look online, if you look at people's Twitter bios, they'll often tell you, you know, libertarian, pro-Brexit, you know, free trade agree, you know. So I think it's just I don't think comedy is really out of step with society there. But you're right. There has been an issue with comedy in the past, I think, not just in terms of presuming its politics, but also that what's called the mainstream era that gave way to the sort of more left-wing alternative era. You know, so people characterise it via Jim Davidson or Bernard Manning, which is often what I get accused of being. Bernard Manning without the jokes is one I've had. At least he had delivery, you know, that sort of thing. You know, at least Jim Davidson got his own TV show, you know, that sort of thing. But I also think, and you'll remember this, is that a lot of the mainstream performers from the 80s were quite silly, weren't they? You know, they were quite family-friendly. A lot of them had puppets. You know, I know a song that will get on your nerves. And so I feel a bit for those guys, is that just because they also wore the dicky bow, they've sort of been lumped in with the bigoted comedy that did exist at that time, but I would argue existed across left and right. I mean, you're not going to tell me that in a working men's club in Middlesbrough in 1982 that there weren't left-wing people that liked a rum joke or two. So
I think my memory stretches back a bit more than you, I think, but I think the issue that when alternative comedy came along really wasn't so much left or right, actually. It was most comedy was done from a white, middle-aged male point of view. So women were funny when they tried to drive, or mother-in-laws were harridans. Who are these strange people who've moved in next door to us who have funny cooking? It was all from that point of view. So when alternative said, oh, wait a minute, you should embrace everybody. And I'm not sure it was particularly support a particular party, though as it happens Margaret Thatcher then came along and she became a target of a lot of comedy because she was quite, well, I think even you as a conservative, it was quite strong in her approach to things and sometimes destructive.
Yeah, I suppose, no, it's a good point that it was about, I guess, this idea that's very prevalent now, which is not punching down or, I suppose, being cliched. The one thing I would say about the 70s is people lived a lot more limited lives, right? They didn't have the entertainment sources that we had. So the reason that those subjects cropped up was because that was the existence that people had. And I'm not defending mother-in-law jokes, but a lot of people at that time, because of, you know, there wasn't a lot of home ownership, a lot of couples were spending the early bit of their married life living with their mother-in-law. So it didn't come from nowhere. And I would argue, I've always wanted to write the modern mother-in-law routine, which isn't just saying that, you know, they're a nightmare, but there is this person that comes into your life who has very strong ideas on how you should be acting. And that is something we all have, you know, that's her daughter, right? So it's something that everyone has to get used to, is that there's someone that can say things to you that perhaps nobody else other than your own mother would have been able to say. So I'm not like defending all of it, but I do think that we sometimes lose the context of how people's lives are organised then.
Well, I don't think I want to encourage you down the line of doing mother-in-law jokes. I think you've got enough things to contend with. Just one more question before we get on to your wonders. Would you compare yourself slightly in a way, though, because you're a bit unique? There are other right-of-centre comedians, but not many. But somebody like Henning Vein is a German comedian. Because that sort of plays into the notion, all the Germans haven't got a sense of humour. So the guy comes along and he is funny and he does jokes about being German. You couldn't litter the world with, you know, 50% of comedians aren't going to be German, and he's got a unique position. Are you just the one allowed right of centre comedian who can pop up on any venue and say, oh, here's an alternative voice, but they don't, alternative to the current fashion, but it's never going to be the case that half the comedians, you say, representing 52% of the people, are going to be in stand-up gigs?
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is something I've argued with the BBC myself, is that, you know, my agent would kill me because she'd say I'm talking myself out of work. But it can't just be me. And it's not about, I don't think the British public are sitting there going, I want right-wing comedy. I want to hear good, because you can't make jokes that, you know, are in support of a political view. That's not the point. I think the point is, on any given panel show or discussion, it would be nice if, say, there was five people or seven people, you had maybe one person, you know, like me, Simon Evans does this very well, that just represented a view that was very common in Britain. I mean, the News Quiz, I would say, is a show that has accommodated that. And, you know, they have people like me, Simon, Alan Cochran. And what it does is it makes it a more rounded discussion. It's better comedically. And I think for the left-wing comics, it gives them something to push back on. So we say something that maybe is a bit more kind of populist in sentiment, or something a bit more small-c conservative. And so instead of them seeming like the establishment stooge, they've then got someone in the room that they can react against. You know, it's useful to have someone on the panel that might not think that every single thing that Meghan and Harry does is absolutely awesome, because the British public as a whole generally don't think that either.
Yeah. Well, I think you're talking yourself into work there, not out of work. You're saying there should be more people like you, but that would include you on the panel to offer.
I just think on every show it would just be useful if there was someone that represented those views. And there are, like as you say, it's not just me now. There are other comics out there, but I think that, yeah, I don't think anyone really is saying 50-50, because simply in the talent pool that doesn't exist. Yeah.
Well, maybe you'll have to pray for a Labour government, because then you can react against it.
I do wonder, because, you know, all those people that said, well, you can't have right-wing comedians on news panel shows because they'll just do jokes about how much they love the government, which A, isn't possible. But then I thought, well, if Labour do win, are those same people going to go, well, you can't have left-wing comedians on now, because all they want to do is high-five Keir Starmer? I suspect they won't.
Well, let's leave politics for a bit. I suspect it'll crop up again. Let's get on with your wonders. And your first wonder is, I suppose, quite a conventional one in a way. Others are less conventional as we come to them. But cricket is your first wonder of the world. Now, I've read your autobiography, Where Did I Go Right, your memoirs. I mean, maybe I was reading it too quickly. I don't remember you mentioning cricket very much in your autobiography. Mm. Is this a new love of yours, or something that's...
No, it's an interesting point. I didn't mention it much, and it's odd because it came to me. So in a way, you say it's a conventional thing, but given my background and where I grew up, cricket wasn't a big part of the sort of sporting and cultural framework. Right. We barely played it at school. No one in my family was interested in it. But then there was this one summer when I was doing my GCSEs where England were playing Australia at home, and I was revising, and it was just this thing that was on, and it had this murmur. And it was just this calmness, and England were getting tonked by Australia. So one of the
that doesn't fix it in time, does it? That's
no. You come back round to that. But what I sort of thought was, I'm still enjoying this, but England are losing, and it wasn't like that with football. Football was very much all or nothing. And I remember there was a match where it was a losing cause, and John Embry scored a 50, and it was great. Like, England were never going to win the match, but I remember he just scored this sparkling 50, and I felt really good about that. And like, it meant something in its own right. And football, consolation goals, no one remembers a great consolation goal. They really, you know, you could do an overhead kick blindfolded from the halfway line, no one would care. But with cricket, you know, someone, you know, England get beat by 300 runs in Perth, but someone actually stands up and scores 100. I remember Ben Stokes doing that on the tour in 2013. So I loved the richness in the punditry. I thought there are these people that spend a lot longer in places and a lot longer in each other's company. I feel like Test cricket is the highest form of sport. It's absolute superior to all sports.
Right. Now, oddly enough, we don't have too many duplications of people's wonders in the ones that I've done so far. I mean, barely more than two or three. But as it happens, both you and Stephen Fry have gone for cricket, and neither of you, sounds though, you actually played it much at the time when you might have done it. You're coming to it later in life, so maybe that is the future for cricket, especially Test cricket, is for people to be introduced to it when they're, you know, they're 30 or something onwards, and they think, I could have been a contender if I'd only played when I was 14.
Well, I played a bit around about the age of 17, but I was really bad. I was a specialist fielder. That was the way I talked myself into a couple of teams, was that I was really enthusiastic at. Basically, you can get in a cricket team if you show being at ease with being hit in the face by a ball.
Yes.
And because that's the weird thing about cricket is there's this gentleness, but also there's this thing that you might get knocked out by a really hard thing travelling about 100 miles an hour. It's a very odd tension. But yeah, I remember to this day, my highest score is 11.
All right.
And I played it again last summer for the first time in a long time. And I scored 6 runs. I was not out. I scored 6 runs in 38 balls. It was awful to watch. Even my own teammates were sort of appealing against me when the ball went past the bat. But I would say that I anchored the innings. I let players.
You sound more like Jeff Boycott than Jeff Norcott.
Well, we're only 2 letters out, aren't we? Yeah. From the name. Yeah. Change the B and the Y for an N and an R.
All right. Well, I think we'll have to organise a game. You can captain one side, and Stephen Fry can captain the other. I don't know what you'd call it. The Ramonas v the
Gammons.
The swivel-eyed Gammons, yeah. What a
swivel-eyed.
Hello, he's going to go around the wicket now. I'd be inclined to stay over and bounce a couple round about the same spot that one went. And what we do know is there are a lot of cracks out there. I went out and had a look at the pitch this morning. I can assure you that I wouldn't be at all happy to be batting on it. And now the Australians have the job.
All right, so cricket, as I say, a conventional and sort of one that you might expect, but your next wonder is salt. I don't know. I have no idea why this should be on a list of wonders, but it's obviously important stuff. But anyway, explain to me why you like salt.
I just really like the taste of it. And I sort of realised that in a lot of foods, it's what I'm craving. All my favourite things are fairly salty. So peanuts, anchovies, soy sauce. It's just, if it was socially acceptable, I think that I might just eat it raw and, you know, drink soy sauce. This is pretty disgusting to admit, but I've actually nibbled an OXO cube in my time, independent, which just because it's quite a salty, stocky flavour. And I don't know if my body has an excessive need for salt. I'm sure it doesn't do me any good, but it's evolved as well. You know, you've got Himalayan rock salt, you've got all these things now. And even now I'm salivating just thinking of salt. So I think what I've done essentially is I've stripped back food to the constituent thing I like about it. And you know, I love a KFC, and I suspect that's not all to do with the 11 herbs and spices, or maybe one of the 11 herbs and spices.
So the spice you want, if it's right to call it a spice, is salt. Well, I think that's quite true of an awful lot of prepared foods. And fast foods, if it's not got sugar in it, it's got salt. And if it's not salt, it's got fat. Those are the things. They're not necessarily brilliant for your long-term health prospects. Salt, I think, is sometimes identified as one of the worst things. So I'm beginning to worry about it.
Without it, we'll also die, though. So it's something your body needs on a fundamental level is, you know, when you've been run a marathon, one of the things you have to replace is the salt. Maybe not the salt that I like or in the way that I would do it. My dad as well, I mean, he was a lot worse than me. He used to have this, because he had one arm, my dad, and he used to have this electronic salt grinder. And me and my wife used to laugh at how long you would hear that noise as it was poised over his fry-up. And he would actually put salt on bacon and ketchup on tomatoes, which I thought was an incredible sort of one in the eye for any sort of sense of nutritional balance. And my son, I've seen it in my son too. Like, you know, I mean, given that my life's changed now, obviously he's tried an olive a lot earlier in life than I did. But he smashed through about 10. And I thought, I know why you're doing this. You're like me. You have the disease.
Well, it may be a disease, but have you developed particular taste for difference, or is it just that salty overall saltiness? Are you buying special sea salt from the?
I'll have that when I'm out having dinner and stuff in the house. I'm a Saxon man, and that's fine. We have salt grinders sometimes. I mean, it's interesting. I know this is slightly off topic, but pepper evolved throughout my life. It was when in the 80s, it was that sort of white milled stuff that didn't really taste of anything. We also had Mellow Bird's coffee at the time, which was almost like a reminder of coffee. Yes. And then pepper become cracked black pepper and stuff. I've actually gone back to, not the white milled pepper, but there was one in between, which was like a little bit strong. I actually think it's better. I think the cracked black pepper, you just get little bits of pepper dotted around. I want like a good sprinkling across all my food. So yeah, I'm a sort of back to basics man at home when it comes to salt and pepper. But I'm willing to, you know, if you go to a restaurant and they give you one of these pesto and mortar things, you might see me dabbing it secretively.
Well, in restaurants, especially Italian restaurants, they bring that huge, those huge pepper grinders around that look as though they've got some symbolic function as they waiters flirt. But apparently it's just to stop you nicking them. You know, they're too big.
Oh, really?
They're too big to steal. But the smell of freshly ground pepper is one of my favourite things. So I wouldn't want to go back to the, as you say, those ghastly little containers of white pepper that stayed around for weeks, years, maybe, having lost its savour, you know, long ago. So
my parents growing up, and my stepdad was like this as well, was that they just didn't seem to like a lot of what food was supposed to be. So the coffee we had didn't taste of coffee. You know, the pepper didn't taste of pepper. They used to cook the crap out of all the vegetables, so there was no semblance of taste. You know, I don't know what it was whether it was a legacy of rationing where foods went back to a very basic point. And so there's that, you know, as an adult, when you get in your 20s and you suddenly realise you have your first crunchy broccoli, yeah. You question everything. we were living off a budget, and then the one thing that we were eating that was nutritious, we were sort of cooking the hell out of it and then throwing away the water. It's very, very hard. There are some things from my childhood that I don't understand, and there are some that I do. Like, one is how we cook vegetables, and the other is the, you know, like playgrounds now routinely have like rubber and wood and stuff to stop you breaking bones. They didn't when I was a kid. It was just concrete, and it's not like the technology didn't exist. Do you remember how many broken bones there were for people falling off slides and roundabouts and stuff?
Well, when I was young, there was a thing in our local park, which we called, I don't know if it was a standard name, called an American swing, which was a great long swing that maybe six of you could be on. And you swung it, you know, the bigger kids on it would swing it more and more. And your aim was to try and get somebody's head near a sort of metal bit that held it up at the top. Yeah. And I don't remember it ever happening that somebody hit their head, but we were always trying to do it. And if you fell off that, you were certainly in trouble.
To introduce Walker's new, tastier salt and vinegar flavour, they're calling them Salt and Vinegar.
Now, your third wonder of the world is Star Wars. I hope I've got that down correctly. I hope it's not Star Trek, because I know there are two different things, Star Wars and Star Trek, and never the twain will meet. So how old were you when Star Wars came out, or when you first saw a Star Wars movie?
So the first film came out when I was about one. I have a vague memory of being in a cinema to watch Empire Strikes Back, but very young. I remember that I went, but I don't remember any details about it. The first time I really remember watching it was on a VHS around a family friend's house. And just you know when the words appear on the screen and there's that sort of trumpety fanfare beginning?
Yeah.
I just thought, this is going to be awesome. Like, I just knew straight away. It was something about the font of the words and the music. And it's interesting because I've indoctrinated my son quite heavily with Star Wars, and it has made me realise how fascists do it. Like, it's so easy when they're young to just get ideas in their heads. I mean, I haven't sort of done it to the point of like, you know what, some maybe the Empire had a point. It's not on that level. But when he saw that first kind of bit of branding and that noise, this look on his face, like, he knew it was going to be great. And you know, I just developed this relationship with it. And you know, if you want to psychoanalyze it, my dad, you know, was an emotionally sometimes unavailable man with a metal arm, you know, a fake arm. So, you know, I always used to get this incredible emotional rush when Darth Vader, right at the end of Return of the Jedi, eventually comes down on the side of his son. And I never really knew why it was. Turns out, a little bit of counselling, Clive. It turns out I'm Luke. The Emperor is, you know, his emotional unavailability. It's all metaphors, mate.
Oh, I see. That's how people relate to it.
I did. I mean, it's cool seeing lasers and big spaceships too.
Well, but it's interesting, though, that you came to it Because when it first came out, there was a lot of hype around it, and the and people got really involved. But you came to it later, so it was an existing thing. It's like coming to a classic book. This is a classic film or series of films. Do you follow it? Are you as enthusiastic about all the Star Wars films? Because they vary in quality, don't they?
Well, so the prequels came out, and I must admit, I was a bit surprised at Phantom Menace, like a lot of people. I think we'd all presume that it would be a continuation of all the things that we liked seeing. Stormtroopers. Yeah. Logically, it couldn't be. So I think it took a long time for people to get their head around that. And as someone who writes now, I do actually respect that George Lucas took a creative risk. It would have been very easy to phone in some more of the same. But he did a bit more world building. And the prequels, actually, and this is where you might get letters, Clive, is the prequels, I think, stand up pretty well, actually. You know, there's an odd dreamlike quality. There's some absolute guff in them. But the stuff that's good... is really good. And then the point where I really got back into it recently was The Last Jedi came out. So this was the second film in the sequel trilogy, if everyone's keeping up. And I didn't know what I thought about it. I thought there was good stuff. And then I found this podcast called Rebel Forces Radio, which is two guys roughly my age that speak about Star Wars for about 2 hours a week. And they just explore all corners of the Star Wars galaxy in microscopic detail. And then since then, obviously, Disney Plus has launched and we have now a Star Wars TV show. So weirdly, in later life, I've got more, the volume of Star Wars I've wanted to have as a kind of 10-year-old, really.
Right. So you are quite an obsessive then. It's not just a favourite film or two. You're in the it's not the Marvel Universe, obviously, but it's a prequel to the Marvel Universe. People have these obsessions about those movies now. Have you moved on to those at all?
I thought they were fantastic. I thought it was a real cinematic achievement. I mean, it's a ridiculous number of films leading up to... I mean, it sort of dwarfed anything before it, but it wasn't like that nip that got you when you were young. You know, it wasn't like that radioactive spider that got you when you were a kid. And I mean, you're right, I am obsessive. When I went on Celebrity Mastermind, which I would say that I won my episode, but I would also add it, I think it was with a record low score. The quality threshold was not high that night.
But it doesn't matter. You have to win the people in front of you, the team in front of you. So as long as you win, you won.
A win's a win. But that was my subject, my specialist subject was the Star Wars prequels. And I did it just slightly, because obviously I'm a bit of a contrarian. I just knew it would wind up the nerds. I just knew that they'd be so cross that I hadn't chosen the original trilogy. But I didn't do as well on it. I took a bold shout. I didn't do as well. I got 5 points, which wasn't great on your specialist subjects. But then I surprised everybody by getting 8 points on general knowledge. I don't know if people remember, but it was the episode where there was a clip that went viral, where there was a young woman from Emmerdale, where they asked her the first name of the famous teenage environmental campaigner, which we all know is Greta Thunberg. Yeah. She said Sharon. I don't know if you remember this clip. She said Sharon.
I do, yeah.
But I was on that. That was the standard that night, Clive.
Yeah. Well, luckily that took the heat off you, I suppose. But yeah. I'm sometimes slightly... sympathetic to people on quiz shows who say something ridiculous, because sometimes you don't know the answer. The thing is to say the first thing that comes into your head to move on, or you think it's right. And if you're all buttoned up, as I would think I probably would be, you say, "Oh, I won't say that then," because we might be said, "Oh no, it turned out it was right. I just should have just said it and get a bit." So I'm sure she just Sharon came into her mind, and it sounded in her mind it's a bit like Greta. So it's
it went to the point where Greta Thunberg actually changed her Twitter profile to Sharon for a few days. So this got pretty big. And you're absolutely right. You know the production, and you know the dark arts of television. You know what they're like. They're not idiots. So they say to you beforehand, don't say pass if you don't know, because they want those moments, right? So
I had
moments before I've been asked about the name of Andrew Lloyd Webber's brother or something. I just said Dave flippantly, you know. And I wonder, I do wonder if I actually teed her up and she thought, oh, well, I'll do something similar like that.
But
the poor woman, you know, 7 million views later, it didn't seem like such a great shout.
So Star Wars, do you rate that alongside... I don't know, great works of literature, Dickens or something, you know, where a whole world is kind of captured in a lot of content or plays, or is it just a thing of the modern world?
I think, yeah, there is a popular element to it. I mean, the story is quite basic, isn't it? They always called it a space opera, and I never fully... You know one of those cool phrases that people get into using that you wonder if they know what it means, like calling the Tory party a psychodrama? I'm never sure people know what they mean when they say that. But I guess, you know, the kid from a small-town place that goes on his hero's journey, I don't think the narratives in it are massively complicated. I think that the fall of Anakin Skywalker to become Darth Vader was a genuinely interesting story, you know, that was pursued with various levels of skill. I think it's something else. I think it's, you know, it was a blockbuster for the reason that it was aesthetically pleasing. It was just cool to look at. It's a very simple, gratifying thing. I mean, the first scene of any Star Wars film is one ship going by, and you think, well, that's a cool spaceship. Mm. And then a massive ship goes by, much bigger, and it's shooting lasers at it. And I've never, you know, I do, you know, I'm reasonably well educated, but I've also got quite a basic side to me, which I'm not afraid of. And I like the popcorn films and, you know, things that just appeal to me, you know, robots fighting. It's cool. Yeah.
So it's got a little bit of the Wild West about it as well, as where people fighting in an anarchic world, plus it almost biblical in, you know, good versus evil. So it's got a lot of things going on for it. But as you say, you might have just liked it for the lightsabers and
the lightsabers. I mean, there is an allegory in there about the Second World War, the way that, I mean, I'll go full nerd, but the way that the Emperor rises to power, there's a lot of kind of analogies there. One thing I do think that has always annoyed me, even as a kid, was the way that all the most evil people were English. Also, that was a bit annoying. You know, like we were the only ones that ever had an empire, and, you know, we'd kill them. And so in the recent TV shows, there was a character who was English and not evil. And I thought, it's good that somebody's finally speaking up for the English community.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Join Luke Moore and me, Pete Donaldson, for an unplanned half hour where we discuss life's great mysteries like, can a man survive by eating roadkill, as well as the week's most bizarre news stories and your ridiculous adventures, like this one about an almost catastrophic shortcut.
We eventually came to a large railed fence, which I decided we should climb. I scaled the 15-foot-ish fence, and as I was sat atop, ready to jump down, three or four police came running from a little building we hadn't noticed before shouting at me and grabbing my mate Sam. I was faced with the choice of legging it onto the other side of the fence or gallantly going back to help my friend. I returned to Sam, and the quite pissed off police and my gallantry was rewarded as they advised me that I had been climbing into the zoo and would have landed in an animal enclosure.
Listen to the Luke and Pete Show wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
The Luke and Pete Show is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
All right, let's go on to your fourth wonder, which is, again, I'm not sure everybody would leap on this. Of all the musicians in the world, U2, you've gone for. Why U2?
Because, I remember my mate Mick, when I was about 13 or 14, Acton Baby had come out, and he just sort of gave me the cassette and said, listen to this. And I remember being on the bus listening to it and thought I possessed this great secret. Like, no one else knows that there's music like this, as good as this. It sounded just from the future. You know, a lot of things that I like, I think, just, I feel like they're from this liminal thing that I can't really put a finger on what it is, but it was both of the past, of its time, and of the future. And that album has stood up very well. But what had happened then was that YouTube got massive, particularly in the late 80s. And then, you know, everyone liked YouTube. And then it became really cool to say that you hated YouTube. I remember on The Word and stuff like that. And even then I thought this was a bit cliched. And then it got to a point where everyone hated YouTube, but still seemed to think that was somehow the marginal viewpoint and they should be applauded or congratulated for being daring enough to sort of agree with seemingly 90% of the population. And like a lot of things that I've sort of defended, you know, cricket as well, is this thing that does have a mass audience, but a lot of people hate. Maybe like the Tory Party.
Well, yeah, I suppose that, you know, we'll get back to the Tory Party eventually, but I suppose there are bands that are like that and performers that people... Everybody you ever talk to seem to dislike. I mean, Genesis is a bit like that. Sells millions of records, but nobody ever, not very few people stand up and say, you know, Joe, I like Genesis. Phil Collins, he's great. He's not said. And I suppose with Bono in particular, because he's a bit of a campaigner, again, it's a bit like Sting. You know, if you're a rock star, if you take cocaine, sleep with a lot of women, that's kind of what we expect you to do. But if you say, oh, we're losing the rainforest or poverty in the world needs, don't tell it. And they all berate. Of course, they did YouTube did that thing of giving away an album and people resented being given some of their music on their Apple devices. Do you think?
Can I just do a bit of very necessary revisionism on that? What people said was that YouTube basically put an album on their Apple device. Wasn't true. Okay, if you looked on your phone, what there was an option to download. It was a token. You were given a token. And it was one of those first big social media huge reaction things where really you got the sense very quickly it wasn't about U2 or the songs. It was people basically wanted to tell you how cool they were and that their musical taste. I mean, people acted like their iPod was this holy repository of everything good in music. What's this crap doing on my iPod? I'm going, all right, let's see everything else that's on your iPod and we'll be the judges of your musical taste. And I thought that the sad thing about that album, Songs of Innocence, it was the late career classic that I think U2 have been promising for some time. It's got some really great songs on it, up there with some of their best work. And it was forever kind of tainted. Yes, there was a touch of hubris about it, but you know, no one said the same when Beyonce did that. It was just that U2 was seen as a bit naff.
Yes. And can you be more precise of putting your finger what makes them a bit naff in the view of music lovers or music commentators?
Well, I think that what they're able to do, I think, I mean, you mentioned Dickens earlier in relation to Star Wars. I think Dickens is a good coder for U2 in that it's something that has mass appeal but is credible. I think that they've managed to bridge that line of stuff that can blare out to 80,000 people in a stadium but still be good music. And I think that people sometimes mistake the fact that a lot of people like it for the fact that it's not credible. And the other one is that Bono's a bit annoying. And I think he would say that he's a bit annoying. But I think that some of his lyrics, I mean, I was listening to a song the other day, The Fly, and there's a line in there where he says, every artist is a cannibal, every poet is a thief. I'd kill for inspiration, let them sing about their grief. Now, if I told you that was Tennyson, you know, if I told you that that was Ginsberg, people would credit that. But I think like lyrically, at his best, he's up there with the greatest songwriters of all time. I can just feel Beatles fans go, what? What? But the Zoo TV tour was the best rock and roll. Right, this is something I will absolutely say. The Zoo TV tour was the best rock and roll tour ever, and it will never be eclipsed, ever.
All right, so you're quite strong on this. This is not
evangelical would be. I mean, I'm like Bono about Bono, ironically,
because they get a bit of flack even in Ireland. They're sort of criticised there, and that's, you know, campaigning on behalf of, you know, against poverty. But then the people turn over their tax arrangements and say, well, you could give, you know, that's accused of hypocrisy, as all rich people are inevitably accused of hypocrisy as they fly around the world preaching about this or that. It's very difficult to be both rich and credible as an arguer in favour of social reform because you're such a beneficiary from it. So if you're a rock star, you're Bono or a member of U2 is what you would be.
I would I would like, I mean, the edge is just, you know, the sound, I know that it's a very treated guitar sound, but when he plays some of those riffs, it just makes me think of something that I can't explain. And he, you know, he's so talented. He can play, there's one song they do New Year's Day where he plays guitar and piano and sings. And I think that sadly there'll be one of those bands that it'll only be when they split up that people go, oh, actually, they were actually quite good, weren't they?
We press the button, it'll take a little longer to get all the way across the internet, but it can start in 5 seconds.
So you two, let me just get this straight. U2's new album, Songs of Innocence, is going out for free to 500 million people in the next 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Instant gratification.
Okay, well, I think there's an element of you like to be a bit going against the tide, so, but you're going with U2. But your next wonder is sounds like an extremely pleasant selection. You've gone for your wife and your son. Mm. So it seems an odd question, but tell me why you've gone for your wife and son. It sounds like you have a happy marriage.
I got married in my mid-20s, which at the time, you know, I thought was what people did, the background I came from. It turns out years later, like, that was not the average age for getting married. You know, my wedding happened, and it's normally like you're going to be going to weddings for the next 5 years. Didn't go to any, really.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I did. And we had you know, a long period before we actually even started trying for kids. And you know, it's such a strong relationship. It's very odd the way that it happened. My wife is my mum, you know, I was single for a while. My mum, who a lot of people called her the White Witch, you know, she had a reputation around the way for being able to predict things and stuff and make things happen. It's a very odd thing. But she said to me, you know, what kind of woman would make you settle down? And I sort of read out a list of sort of personal and physical attributes. And then I met, you know, Emma shortly after that, and who was literally, this is how specific it was. When I gave my kind of shopping list to my mum, I said, oh, and, you know, she'd probably do some charity work. And when I met Emma, you know, she was doing voluntary work for the Samaritans and stuff. So it was quite incredible. And so I proposed, like, really quickly, within 6 months, which I think, looking back, scared the hell out of my in-laws. Like, they very smartly said, well, let's schedule the wedding for a year and a half's time. I didn't realise it at the time, but it was a very smart sort of cooling off period.
So what period in your life was that? Were you a trainee teacher, a teacher, an aspiring comedian, already established comedian? Where were you in your life?
I was still working in advertising. I was started to do comedy, and then I became a trainee teacher. So in the first sort of 2 years of me being with my wife, I had three career changes, which again, the in-laws did well to not pass on. There's any fear, you know, the next thing I was going to say was, like, oh, I'm going to be a BMXer or a professional frisbee champion.
So Emma thought she was marrying somebody working in advertising who was going into teaching. That's the sort of person she thought. And she's found that she's married to an ex-teacher, an ex-person in advertising, who is a pretty well-known comedian, you know, in the public eye, a little bit controversial here and there, but certainly well-known. So has she coped with that well?
It's interesting. She's not fussed about comedy at all, which I think is a good thing. She has a certain cynicism about it, which is healthy. I was doing a comedy a long time before I did anything on telly at all. So for her, the small bits of recognition that I do get when we're out, it's been odd because she just had a long time to get used to it not being like that. You know, and I did quite a lot of writing for TV shows from about 2009 to 2015. So, you know, I had a bit of a proximity to the glitz and the glamour, but nothing too direct. So that she has said that has been, you know, that has been strange for her. Whereas, you know, it's the opposite with my son, who my son was born just as things were starting to happen. So he's got this kind of inbuilt sort of belief in himself as a performer because he just thinks that all the things that I do are pretty standard, you know. I
mean, they're normal, yeah.
And I'm not, there's a lot of people will be listening to this now that didn't know who I was before. I'm not a household name by any stretch of the imagination, but I just have a bit of recognition. And he did his little talk at school about, you know, they did, what does your mummy or daddy do? And he spoke to him about my job, and he actually plugged the book at the end. Which is always, that's it. That's my boy.
You've taught him well, yes.
Very much so, yeah. You all need to get your mummies and daddies to buy my daddy's book.
Well, I just while we've come across it, so you get some recognition. People might say, oh, I saw you on the MASH report. So they might say, oh, I saw you on the MASH report. But they might also say, and I thought you were talking a load of rubbish, or you were speaking for the nation. You know, do you get sort of like a politician might get, as well as just somebody who's on telly and being funny?
Online, I do. I used to get it a lot more. I mean, if you think about, you know, the Brexit years and under Corbyn, like things were actually, people won't think it, but things were a lot more rancorous than they are now. I know that now is always the worst time ever. But so when, and just the idea of anyone right of centre doing comedy, people felt like it's something that shouldn't happen. They should shut down. So I had, you know, like a lot of quite violent reactions to things online. There was one guy once that sent me a sort of threat who turned out to be a lay preacher at a church, which was quite phenomenal. But yeah, in person, people are pretty sound. I don't think I've had anyone ever pop. Do you know what I do get, Clive? Is there's a certain kind of young woman who looks a bit right on and stuff, and I see her go, I know that bloke, and then go, I know that bloke. And you know that noise that young women make now, like, ugh, that the ugh noise. I can sort of see that happening in their brain. But I mean, the thing that I would say is that, and I hope, there was a point with Brexit where I was maybe a bit more combative. I was never ideologically a Brexiteer, but I was very strong in the idea that we should, you know, enact the result of the referendum, that perhaps it was a bit more like that. But my goal isn't to be an edgelord or exclude everybody. I think the much more interesting challenge is to keep a coalition in the room, to keep people from both sides on side. So hopefully the grown-ups can see that that's what I'm trying to do.
Anyway, we're back to your wife and son. We're drifting back into politics. We should do some more. But and she's not in the world of comedy, so she no. Your wife, she looks on. You like her being in a family life then, and you enjoy going home after where you've done a distant gig, anyway. You're happy to get home again.
I always, you know, if I can drive home, I will. You know, a lot of comics will stay over and stuff, but my sort of tariff is anything less than 3.5 hours, and I will drive back because there's just something about waking up in your own house. I mean, it might not be much fun for them, is that I wake up kind of zapped from both the gig and the drive. But you know, when you wake up, and I mean, I had this on Sunday night, so I did a gig in Cardiff, and that was more than 3.5 hours. So I stayed at a Travelodge in Swindon West, and it was just sad getting there. It was sad getting up. And, you know, your week starts in a strange way. So I've never been one to stay around drinking or anything. I like my home life. I also like keeping normal hours so I'm in touch with my family. So getting up, you know, with the family, doing the breakfast thing as well.
So you obviously have a happy home life, though. I hope it's not inappropriate to note in passing you've got your son, but you did have another child who's stillborn. So you've had sadness of the deepest sort in your family as well.
Well, I mean, the thing about stillbirth that is complicated for people that go on to have kids, but in a good way, is that my son is so fantastic and incredible and amazing. Like, it literally just couldn't have asked for a better kid. But there are some complications in that you feel, how much am I allowed to enjoy this? You know, like there's survivor's guilt in a very complicated way. That it comes and goes in waves, you know, and you realize how happy you are, and then it's almost like an elastic band that is attached to your back in a wall that goes, no, you have to be snapped back to sadness, otherwise you didn't care. So it is, you know, and I know people contact me about, you know, I wrote an article last year for Sands as well, which, if people are interested in this, or if they know anyone that's gone through it, because in terms of men speaking about this, it's a very small field, you know. So I shared an article which people seem to find useful. But that took me 7 years to be able to talk about it, you know. Yeah. So it is a very complicated thing. Obviously brutal for women, but what often happens with blokes is that you can get lost in the mix. But yeah, the fact that, as you say, the bond between me and my wife is already so strong, and you know, that we went through it together and we kept talking about it, is that we, you know, it does feel like the bond is unbreakable, really.
Mm. All right. Well, that's a wonderful wonder. It's way your wife and son. But your next wonder takes us back into the rough world of politics again, because it's Prime Minister's Questions. That's the parliamentary procedure, which a lot of people enjoy, even though they don't watch much else in politics. It's the Prime Minister of the day being, well, possibly torn apart, not actually, but torn apart by his or her opponents. Well, is that what you like about it, the brutal, bear-baiting quality?
Yeah, and I think it's what everyone pretends that they don't like, and I find it a bit a bit disingenuous when people say they'll tune in for it on the day that they know that it's going to be like that. So there's a report out or Boris has said something, and then they'll go, oh, this is disgusting, this is despicable. You go, you knew what it was going to be like. It's the bit, the weeks where it's respectful and constructive, boring, frankly.
Yeah.
And there is a value to it, even when it is kind of rancorous like that, is that you are just finding out a little bit like what your leader is like under pressure, or your potential opposition leader is like. How do they react, you know, like what is their moral fiber, and you find out interesting things about them, as we have with Boris Johnson of late. And I think that, you know, we don't sort of reflect enough on what a unique thing is in our democracy. I mean, I remember when Barack Obama came over and saw PMQs, he was very thankful that there wasn't equivalent in US politics, and it is, there's a weird thing where when I'm watching PMQs and enjoying it, it activates a similar part of my brain to cricket and sport. Yeah. You know, I love, you know, like the jokes, and I love the interventions from the speaker. And I think that, I mean, I remember it used to be twice a week, and it probably did. That was too much, really. But once a week, I hope that we never get rid of that from our politics. I think it's a really healthy thing.
Well, it's one of those things you think, well, that must be in some way written into the Constitution, this happens. But you're right, it was twice a week. It was a quarter of an hour twice a week. And Tony Blair just said, oh, I can't be bothered to have to prepare for this twice a week. We'll have the same amount of time. We'll just do it on one day. And people say, well, how can you do that? You can't just, you're the one being questioned. But it turns out he could do it. And now we're all used to the fact that we have half an hour, often more than half an hour. And you're right, a lot of people say they don't like it. The speaker spends most of his time saying, oh, the people at home hate this when you're being shouted down. But I agree with you. There's plenty of stuff goes on in Parliament, and it's all available on the Parliament Channel if you want to. When people sit around and they consider things, the only things we like, or the mass audience, or something like a mass audience, as Prime Minister's questions are, and when other things develop into something like a committee where it all kicks off and they start tearing chunks out of somebody else. So that's what we, but whether it's the best way to come to decisions, whether it's the best judge of a prime minister or a potential prime minister, who knows? I mean, William Hague was always brilliant as leader of the opposition, but Tony Blair just developed a way of saying, oh, yes, very good joke, laughed at his joke, oh, very good joke, very good point, but your guest's going nowhere, mate, which turned out to be the case.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a different culture of the way that we consume it now. Like Blair wasn't, you know, there weren't viral clips then, you know, and it's a weird thing to say with someone as kind of a bit old-fashioned as Hague that he might have actually benefited from that. But the negative to that is that you do often get politicians who stand up and you can sort of see them check the camera, and the SNP do this a lot where they sort of try, they always say, oh, they quote like a bit of slang from their part of Renfrewshire that no one else will understand. they're constantly playing to this one gallery. I mean, Ian Blackford recently, you know, when Boris was absolutely on the ropes, I mean, it was, he somehow found a way of making it about him. He was like a footballer trying to get sent off, and I thought, this is so ridiculous and counterproductive. But but I guess that is, you know, a part of the theatre, and you know, there's never more exciting in a way. This is the thing about the Conservatives, is there's a lot of problems there at the moment, but they often have formed the best opposition to themselves as well. Over Brexit, they organise well against themselves, and you know, when you get things like David Davis and Theresa May, I mean, you like those are memorable things. When it's blue on blue, let's be honest, that's the sexiest politics gets.
Well, look, we're recording this. This is not a topical program in the sense. This is a podcast to put out, and people may come across this in a week's time, in 3 months' time. I don't know. But at the moment, Boris Johnson has gone on this strange journey from being this real popular figure to now he's completely, in many people's views, completely destroyed himself with the wish to have parties, office parties, which seems the least attractive thing to destroy your career. So you, as a Conservative supporter, and presumably admired
the way he won the election and how he steered the country, if he can be given the credit for that, through Brexit. But he's now, a liability. Would you think that was inevitable because that's the type of person he is? Or are you disappointed? I don't know. What's your view?
In December, I said, I probably wouldn't vote Conservative again while he's still in power. And in the run-up to the 2019 election, it was, like people said, well, they held their nose and voted for Corbyn in 2017. There was a degree of that with me and Boris in 2019. He's just not my style of politician. I quite like Theresa May. I like somebody who looks like they're not enjoying it. I think that's probably a healthy sign. It shows
she looked awfully like she wasn't enjoying it.
She was getting heckled by her own voice. I mean, I like people with a sort of sense of civic duty. So he was never my kind of guy. I think that given the constitutional deadlock that we were in over Brexit, I am grateful that he was the person that evidently, for whatever reason, could undo that. And I think that throughout the course of the pandemic, they've made, got some of the big calls wrong, but got a lot of them right as well. But there are a lot of people in the Conservative Party that sort of think, well, it's only 2.5 years ago he won this big majority. And like, yeah, but that 2.5 years was a global pandemic. I'm going to say that counts for about 7 years. And I just think that in politics, there has to be a sending off offence. There has to be a straight red. And I think Lyons of Parliament, which I think that he's done, I think bringing forward the Plan B measures as a dead cat, I think he did that. And I think that, the comments about Starmer were so unedifying. I just think it's time. He served a purpose at a point in time. I was never fully at ease with it. Yeah. But I want him to go. And then you get in that funny position now where I've always been got stick for being too right-wing. Now I get Tories giving me stick for being, you were never really a Tory. And I'm like, yeah, neither is Boris, just in case you ain't noticed.
So again, as I say, this may stay in existence for ages, but let's assume you're right, and there's plenty on your side would agree with you, that Boris is going to go. Who is going to replace him? Who should replace him? Or who do you want him to be replaced by?
Well, I like Rishi Sunak. I think that he is, he's a bit fond of the branding and being young and cool and being liked. But, he did a press conference recently. And on a day when Boris was absolutely on the ropes and shambolic, he was just across his brief. Like he knew every question. This sounds awful, Clive, that this is like a shock to me and something that I'm particularly encouraged by. But he answered well, and there is a statesmanlike quality to him. And I think it's good, every once in a while to have a young prime minister. I think he's got good people around him. There is a part of me that sometimes wonders if I would just enjoy saying to the Labour Party, well, look, two female leaders, now a British Asian, because there is that strange irony about the Labour Party that are progressive, but just somehow in their long history, it's never been quite the right time to have a female leader. It's never been. But ultimately, I think he is the best available option. I think someone like Penny Mordaunt, there are certain figures in the party that should be closer to number 10 than they currently are, and I think he'd bring them in.
Yeah, well, it's hard for these days for politicians to really break through unless you are the Chancellor of the Exchequer, maybe if there's a lot of things going on in the Home Office, which is normally difficult. Other than that, we don't really know who as outsiders, we don't really know who the people are, and they have those leadership contests now, but whichever party comes through, you think, well, who is this guy? I've never heard of him. And you end up even with somebody like Tony Blair, who became Prime Minister, having, I don't think he'd ever been in government, which is an extraordinary situation we've got ourselves into. This is me just rambling, but America, they seem to be incapable of electing as president anybody younger than about 70, and we can't manage to come up with Prime Ministers who, they've got to be just 5 years into it. It used to be the case you'd put 20 years in the Home Office, the Foreign Office, and then you became Prime Minister, and then you retired. Now they have a burst and they hang around.
It was funny in the US election because, a lot of people on the left in the US, some of the charges against Trump are, an old white guy, and then they went for somebody older and whiter. Which the only person left in politics that satisfied those two criteria. But I think politics, it does all occupy a different space in our discourse now than it did. But people are more political, and there's good and there's bad that goes with that. But the fact that, most people now know who the Home Secretary is maybe even more in the cabinet than that. There was a period under New Labour where it was very apolitical. Turnouts were down. You know, people were not engaged. So I like the fact that people are talking about it, but I don't like the fact that people talk about it so much that they jostle people outside of Parliament. Mm. But it's hard. It seems to go hand in hand.
We're just about to come to your last wonder, but before we do that, just conscious of that, I've asked you an awful lot about politics and not as much about comedy as I might have done. So you obviously enjoy making jokes, you enjoy making people laugh. What do you think about fellow comedians and where their jokes should go? And I've got in mind that currently, at this time of recording, you've got someone like Jimmy Carr, who's a month after something's been broadcast, people have noticed there's a joke in it. I mean, jokes don't always say something, but he had a joke basically celebrating mass murder by Nazis. And that's the shock value, but I don't know what other value there is in there. Where would you stand on that? Criticise him for that? Or
I mean, I just generally, the tribe that I am part of first and foremost is a comic, so I'm never going to people, we all make creative choices. I would sort of push back on the idea that he was celebrating that. I think that for his point of view, the joke was just saying the worst thing, and the show is called His Dark Materials. I think that you have to accept as a comic that sometimes things do cause legitimate offence and indeed hurt. Like, those are real feelings. You're not in control of that. You can't tell people they can't feel like that. My big question is, what happens as a result of those feelings? What do people think that they should do with that feeling? Should that person be stopped from having work or deplatformed? Should that show be censored? That's where I come in and take take issue. And there is context to that joke, but in a sense that it's on a streaming service, right? So you don't have to have Netflix, you don't have to click on Jimmy Carr's thing. And the show, as I say, is called His Dark Materials. He's a very different comic to me. I despite what some people may think of me, I'm very careful about targets and how I go for things, because I think that having talked about how I voted, it would be all too easy for people. I mean, if I straight out of line, they go, well, this is classic Tory, and in a way, there's a perverse part of me that just doesn't want to make it easy for them. I'm very careful in terms of the status of the jokes that I do. But Jimmy, over a long period of time, has said, the unsayable things. And it's more the reaction to the jokes that worries me, like where you've got an SNP councillor. I know it's only an SNP councillor, but still an elected official saying, oh, we should prosecute him for hate speech and his audience. I don't know what she thinks is possible, like football hooligans where you have a banning order and they have to turn up at between 8 and 10 p.m. at their local nick and check in. Yeah. So it's as most things. I do think what is odd to me is that you can't say that it wasn't a joke, right? You can get as upset as you want, but what you don't get to do is pretend that it was something completely different to a joke.
Mm. Yeah. We come on to your last wonder, onto happier times or happier time of the year, because spring is your seventh wonder. Why? Again, it's a slightly odd thing to say. Why? What do you like about spring? But enthuse about spring.
It is. Well, I think it's the best season, objectively, because what you have is, just like Christmas Eve is better than Christmas Day and poppadoms are better than the curry, is it's the thing before the thing that routinely disappoints, right? So spring, the days are getting longer, it's getting warmer, flowers, but loads of great stuff, right? Loads of great stuff. It's all on its way. And then, once you get into summer's great, but it happens all too quickly that they go, oh, the nights are getting shorter now. You go, what is that mean, summer a month? It's the end of June. And then, so summer can be fun. British summer's not always the most predictable things. And then you get the worst people in the season debate, which is the autumn fanatics, who are so defensive about autumn, and they the reasons that they give for autumn being great are so weak. Like, it's got the leaves are so beautiful and the sunsets and you go, summer is dying before your eyes, right? Everything's being stripped bare. You've got these naked kind of spiky looking trees. And it's not only that, it's the long, slow walk into winter. Like, once you get in winter, you go, all right, we're in now. This is bad. Hunker down. Let's get through it. But autumn is that false hope of, oh, it was 20 degrees today. And then it gets weirdly cold at around 4 p.m. So I think that spring, I don't like to be too didactic, but I think it's objectively the best season.
I like the way you've set up this argument between these four camps, like they're political parties.
Well, I've moved on from Brexit now, you know.
Yeah, I know, but the autumnists, they're so hopeless. The deluded people in the summer.
Yeah.
You're not even allowing the winter files, the people who actually like it in the cold weather, you've kind of dismissed them as non-existent.
But, well, you know, they exist. I think that, you know, if we wanted to get culture war about this, I have noticed a Venn diagram between autumn fans and your liberal sort of metropolitan elites. They're exactly the sort of people that want opportunities to wear pashminas and certain tones, you know, certain kind of coats. So maybe, yeah, like most of me, it comes back to my suspicion of and fear of becoming middle class.
All right. So now you see, you're going to hate me because in my typical BBC way, I like every season of the year. And when you get to, no, but really, I mean, I genuinely do. Spring, I can see, oh, spring, it is lovely. Anti-spring. Summer, oh, are these long nights, hot weather, if we're lucky, holidays are on. Oh, but I also like that sort of feeling of autumn. But I enjoy a walk in the winter or snow on the ground. So I'm beyond woolly liberal on this. I think there's good and bad in all seasons. I think that's
2022, that. Clive. You got to pick a side. This is a
pick a tribe.
it's got you prevaricate. I mean, no, I think winter has. I mean, the thing about autumn is it's so devoid of anything good. The things that do happen in autumn. There are no bank holidays, by the way. I mean, that's a problem. And they have Guy Fawkes Night, so no one's really that exercised about. Everyone sort of hates politics, but we celebrate, you know, a plot failing to blow up Parliament. We've had to import Halloween from the States just to try and jazz up, because people knew it was dying on his arse. So what can we do just to give it a little bit something? And I would say
I disagree with you. It wasn't dying. It was a very jolly festival. Throwing a body of a traitor on a bonfire in a cheery way for the children, and it's been upstaged by this Halloween, which is, I don't know what that relates to. I don't know. It was something we exported to America hundreds of years ago. We're happy to see the back of it. It's come back and bit us.
I think, you know, there is one thing I like of Halloween, and this goes back to the sort of wonder of my son, is that there is a very American thing that happens here now, but it's actually good, which is pumpkin picking, where at a certain point in the year, a lot of farms just open, all the pumpkins are on the floor, and they've made it a thing, and it's nice. And everyone sort of says, I guess it's easy to be cynical about American imports. You go, well, some of it is popular because it's good.
Trick or treating. Do you enjoy kids banging on your door at 7 in the evening and demanding more chocolates, or they'll do what? They never actually seem to have much of a trick up their sleeve. It's
I didn't like it, and then I saw my son at the age of 4 dressed as a cute vampire, and I thought, I get it now. It's not for them, you know. They get sweets. There's a little deal going on here. I get to see him looking cute. I mean, he's coming up 6 now. If I could get him to dress as Anakin Skywalker in the Star Wars prequels, which he does have a passing resemblance, so. There are, yeah. Look, all right, yeah. I'm going to give it all. Autumn is better than it was, but it's still, leaves are not a reason to love it.
So I've been, and I've been benefited in doing this podcast from reading your memoir, Where Did I Go Right, which How the Left Lost Me. So I suppose people can catch up on more stuff about you and your attitude to the wonders of life by tracking down a copy of that. I've seen you doing stand-up 2 or 3 years ago now, but you're still touring. Have you managed to conquer COVID and get out there? And
yeah, you know, I was out in the autumn, because obviously people need things in the autumn to make them happy. And we're back out from February 2022 right up until May. And you're right, this guy, it's the final date of the tour. Is, you know, like a lot of comedians, their big goal is I'm going to play. And I'm going to Newcastle, Carlisle, Ipswich, Portsmouth, a lot of places. Yeah. But a lot of people, they want to play the Apollo. All the young comics have got to play the Apollo. Yeah. Not me, Wimbledon Theatre. 29th of May, Wimbledon Theatre, the place that I first saw Panto, the place that I saw Christopher Biggins in a skirt. That is the home of comedy, and that is my one London day.
You saw Christopher Biggins in a skirt in Wimbledon. I'm going to be there one day, not necessarily in a skirt or Christopher Biggins, but in this theatre, I'll be performing there.
The 29th of May, it's the homecoming gig. I just thought, you know, like I say, I always do things a bit different, but it sort of appealed to me that there's something. And I just saw Shane Ritchie doing Panto there in December, and I thought, I might incorporate some Shane Ritchieisms. You know, it's possibly the point where my mainstream sensibilities and my comic sensibilities meet.
All right. Look, Jeff Norcott, thank you very much for sharing your seven wonders with me. I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it in this podcast. And you make a reasonable case for all of your wonders, but I think the one where I felt your emotions were most engaged, really, was when you're talking about your wife and son. So maybe I'm getting a bit soft as I'm going through these, because I keep picking these family ones the last few I've done. But anyway, I'm going for, I don't know your wife or your son, but from the way you talk about them, they cope very well with being in a family with you. And so I'm going to make your wife and son the one I select as the wonder of wonders from this podcast. So thank you very much for joining me, Jeff.
Thank you.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.